Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain." So Naomi says, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Boaz said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they responded, "May the Lord bless you." And Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant in charge answered, "She's the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." She said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers." She came and has remained from the morning until now. And Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, do not go glean in another field. Do not go from this one, but stay here with my maid. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered and said to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work, and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." And she said, "I have found favor in your sight, my lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied, and even had some left. And when she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. And also you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles, and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. And her mother-in-law said, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man is Boaz." And Naomi said, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Naomi said to her, "That man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives." Or a more direct translation would be, "He is our kinsman redeemer." May God bless this reading of His holy word. You may be seated. I'm going to do something different this morning. Perhaps every 7 years it's allowed. This is a emotional week for me, it always is. It's a week where, in a sense, my whole life sort of converges. Both my sons' birthdays are this week. My father's birthday is this week. Father's Day is this week. My brother died this week. And 19 years ago, on June 18th, we arrived, my wife and I, in Crystal River to begin this work. So my labors here began this week. So particularly of all those events, I suppose that which is most significant to me is the fact that it's Father's Day and the fact that it's the week of my son's birthdays. 7 years ago, I wrote a letter to my son when he was 13 years old, my oldest son. I have four children. I have a son named Tony. He turns 20 on Tuesday. He is a student at Florida State University. I have two daughters, Kristen, who's going to Covenant College. She just graduated from high school. She's 18 years old. I have a daughter named Amy. She's 16 years old. She'll be entering 11th grade. And I have a son, Tucker, who I'm immensely proud of. And he's entering 6th grade. He turned 11 years old last week. When my son turned 13, I wrote him a letter, and I read it in church. It's not exactly like I would write to him if I were only writing to him. It's a sermon, admittedly. My son, I probably wouldn't talk to him a lot about Ruth and Naomi if I wrote him a letter. So this is a sermon, and you're invited to follow along. You have a sermon outline that will trace the basic content. But this is a sermon that comes in the form of a letter to my son now on his 20th birthday, on the precipice of adulthood. What might a father say to his son? So, different sermon, because not only it's in that form, but because I'll be reading it. Dear son, 20 years old, wow. As your sisters would say, how the heck did that happen? It's hard to believe it's already been 2 decades since your mom woke me up on June 18, 1982, to announce that she wasn't going to work that day, she was going to labor. And labor she did for almost 24 hours. I've never forgotten that in the not-so-distant past, you wouldn't have survived this difficult birth. I would have lost you and your mom. The whole trajectory of my life would have been radically altered. There would have been no Kristen, Amy, or Tucker, and perhaps no Seven Rivers Church. But God was there, and so was Dr. Beverly McMillan, a woman who had opened the first abortion clinic in the state of Mississippi. But now, transformed by God, she was using her hands to give babies life. I'll never forget, as they wheeled your mom to emergency surgery, I grabbed Dr. McMillan and asked, is everything going to be all right? She looked at me and without blinking quoted from Psalm 139, the Lord knows the days that are ordained for your child, when as yet there is not one of them. They are already written in his book. With that, she turned and led me in to watch the surgery. I wept when you were born. It's not a slight to your siblings, but it was the happiest day of my life. My lifelong ambition was fulfilled. For more than any desired career, the one thing I aspired to be was a dad. And who wouldn't want to be the mentor in a son's life? Is there a higher calling? I love this poem. Mark Hopkins sat on one end of a log and a farm boy sat on the other. Mark Hopkins came as a pedagogue and taught as an elder brother. I don't care what Mark Hopkins taught, if his Latin was small and his Greek was not. For the farmer boy, he thought he, all through the lecture time and quiz, this kind of man I mean to be, the kind of man Mark Hopkins is. No printed word or spoken plea can teach young hearts what men should be. Not all the books on all the shelves, but what the teachers are themselves. For education is making men. So it is now, so it was when Mark Hopkins sat on the end of a log and President James Garfield sat on the other. Well, Tony, it was sobering to be the one appointed to sit on the end of the log as your teacher. I know, though, I've passed on to you my hard-earned wisdom. Things like how to style your hair, how to always be right when arguing with a woman, how to invest in tech stocks when they're at the height of their inflated value, how to plan a vacation crammed with historical sightseeing but absolutely devoid of any fun, and how to compete at Monopoly in such a way that no one enjoys playing with you. But now a new stage of your life is dawning, and looking back, you are a trophy to the grace of God. You survived childhood with a father who was too often driven and distant. You traversed teenagedom with a dad clueless about how to connect. You bore the burden of having dad as the preacher and having to go to school daily at your old man's workplace. Where's the anger, the meltdown, the rebellion, the running away from all things Christian and all things Cortese? It's not there. You're doing so well in life, in school, in relationships, in work, in church. How did that happen? Could it be there was another father at work? The man I longed for you to be, you have become, because God deigned to be your teacher. So what would I long for you, for the next leg of your journey? Well, what Paul longed for his followers when he wrote, equip yourself like a man, be strong, let all that you do be done in love. There are a cacophony of voices in our culture that wish to neuter males and squash masculinity. Those same voices will later be heard to lament, where are the real men? Francis Schaeffer said, the dilemma of modern man is simple. He doesn't know why his life has any meaning. Tony, what I want for you more than anything on the cusp of adulthood is to know the security of God the Father as your strength and the graciousness of God the Father as your heart, that you might acquit yourself as a man. It is your calling to be a man. strong and tender. For instruction on that, let's consider Ruth and Boaz and Naomi. Tony, I want you to find in the Father's strength your security. You have a Father who loves you and won't be put off by your sin and ugliness, and will use all of life's events, especially the hard stuff, to mold you as his child. Look at Naomi. She's returned to Bethlehem, poor, widowed, without sons, food, or a future. Her Moabite daughter-in-law, Ruth, seeks the field of someone kind enough to allow her to glean. When chapter 2, verse 3 says that Ruth happened into the field of Boaz, who is not only rich and influential, but their relative, we know that she didn't happen there. This was no mistake. What looks like purely happenstance is, in fact, the hand of a sovereign God ordering the affairs of those he loves. God was caring not only for Ruth and Naomi, but arranging a future marriage from which would come the forebears of Jesus. God was at work even through Ruth. God was at work even though Ruth and Naomi had no clue. And Tony, if there's anything that will serve you in good stead for adulthood, it is the sure conviction that God is not only ruler and Lord, but he is always at work for your good, always. Let this be your strength and security. Remember when you were 13, you went to basketball camp in Gainesville, you had the worst team, the worst coach, no roommate, never won a game. Well, God was there, and he had a purpose in it. It wasn't the worst disappointment you'd ever been through in Gainesville, was it? When doctors operated to remove a tumor from your spine 6 years before that at Shands Hospital, and the surgery didn't work, God knew what he was doing then, too. And when you mashed that same spine on the trampoline this Christmas and thought for the briefest moment you'd lost the use of your limbs, God was at work. God won't let your life be a cakewalk because he doesn't want you soft. He needs his sons fierce and tough. He needs men. Chapter 2, verse 12 says, Ruth sought refuge under the wings of God. Son, I have no more fervent wish for you than that you would seek shelter there too. It will make you tough to seek shelter. Psalm 91 says, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. That was the life verse of Jim Elliot, who gave his life in an Ecuadorian jungle, killed by the very tribe he went to love as a missionary. The Jim Elliot who said, he is no fool to give up what he cannot keep, to gain what he cannot lose. Son, may the security of God's watch care and his unfailing grip on you sustain you through the darkest nights of your life and set you free to serve Jesus boldly and without fear. I've lived my life with so much fear. May you be stronger, but not with the strength that it is your own, but strong because your heavenly Father is a warrior. Following this on your outline? Tony, to acquit yourself as a man, you must not only be strong like your father, but you must have the graciousness of his heart as well. In Ruth 2, we see this exemplified in the life of Boaz. You must have a heart blown away by grace, like Jean Valjean in Les Miserables. You remember him as the starving ex-convict who in desperation steals golden candlesticks from a rectory where he's been fed and cared for. When the gendarmes capture and return him to the priest to confess his thievery, the priest exclaims to the police, no, he's not a thief. I gave him those candlesticks. And I'm so glad you brought him back because he forgot the goblets I gave him as well. This singular act of unmerited favor and grace changed not only Valjean's life, but his heart. Tony, the world needs men who have learned the heart of their father. It is a heart that doesn't overlook the needy. In ancient Israel, God told his people, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very corners of your field. Do not gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. Leave that to the needy and the stranger. God cared about the fatherless, the widow, and the poor, and so when they harvested the produce, they left the edges of the field for the needy. Many farmers wouldn't do this. They had ways of making gleaning in their fields burdensome. But Boaz knows that his fields and the fruit of them are the Lord's, and God wants some of the produce to go to the poor. Tony, no Christian should scorn the poor. For all of us are dependent. I've yet to meet anyone who's provided for himself. Everybody I know receives welfare. All our provision is from God. Your generation is the greatest generation in this regard. They hate big talkers. If a church is blabbering on about the gospel and about the Bible, but they're not serving the poor, you won't go. Your mom and your grandma have been good models of caring for needy people. Mom's heart is huge, And Grandma has been blessed with a lot of comforts in life, but has volunteered at a thrift shop for migrant workers for years. When I was just 17, I lived with a pastor and his family in Webster County, West Virginia, the poorest part of America. Less than half the population had indoor plumbing. Impoverished people came to the pastor's door for food almost daily. Once a family living in a car after their trailer burned down came by, and I saw the pastor's wife give them one of the children's bedroom furniture. This family didn't give their surplus or their garage sale items. They gave what they were still using. Tony, acquit yourself as a man by being strong for those who have no strength. And perhaps God will even use your generation to accomplish what my generation has not. The legal protection of the weakest among us, the unborn. Tony, if your heart is to be like your father's, it will be full of wisdom. Throughout Ruth 2, Boaz is portrayed as one who is wise. He is prosperous for his wise management. He couldn't have been generous and benevolent if he hadn't been prosperous. Boaz is also wise with his counsel to Ruth. I commend to you, son, the value of wisdom, the value of being a good thinker. Proverbs 24 says, my son, eat honey. It's good. The honey from the comb is sweet. Know that wisdom is thus for your soul. If you find it, there will be a future. In our world, being ignorant is cruel. To sprinkle one's speech with comments like dude, like it was an awesome thing, dude, is to betray the fact, man, that I am totally ignorant, dude, and have no ability to form a coherent sentence. Dude. To acquit yourself as a man, you must be about learning books, theology, and intellectual discussion. Working out in the gym is great, but girding up the loins of your mind is even more useful. What our world most lacks is wisdom. Jesus said, the truth shall set you free. Our world is shackled by untruth, son, but you are unusually bright. In fact, a lot smarter than I am. And God wants to make you a source of wise counsel for those who need to be pointed in the way of life. It was said of Jesus that he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. That's my prayer for you, Tony, in the college years and beyond. Tony, your father has made you to have a heart that is committed to serving and protecting women. Ruth tells us that Boaz inquires about the girl laboring in his fields, and his foreman praises her for her modesty and diligent labor. Boaz immediately takes her under his watch care, commands that she be treated with respect and that her needs be tended to. It is a disappearing virtue in our culture. But God's sons are to treat women with respect and honor. You know, opening doors, speaking gently, ladies first, etc. I read of an Air Force commander who was relieved of his duty because he could not in good conscience send a woman pilot into harm's way. I say God bless him, and I know God will. I am responsible to protect your mom and your sisters. I can promise you that no boy will consistently date your sisters without my involvement. I remember being at a basketball game and planning to go home at halftime when I noticed one of your sisters sitting awfully cozy with a guy I didn't know. Well, let's just say I stayed for the second half. But it wasn't the game I was watching. Too protective? Perhaps, but they are too precious not to protect. And I want any boy to know that if he tampers with your sisters, it would be better for him if a millstone were tied around his neck and he were cast into the depths of King's Bay. In the chronicles of my life, some of my greatest sins have been times when I failed to honor your mom. Unfortunately, you were usually around to observe them. There is no failure any worse than to not honor the woman God gives us. Protecting the girls and mom is my job, but if I'm not around, it's yours. Equip yourself like a man, Tony. That's what Teddy Roosevelt was trying to train his Sunday school boys to do, and one of his charges arrived in class with a black eye. He admitted he'd been fighting, and on Sunday, too. He told the future president that a bigger boy had been pinching his sister, and so he fought him. Roosevelt commended the boy and gave him a dollar, and he was dismissed as a Sunday school teacher for rewarding such behavior. Acquit yourself like a man, like Andrew Jackson, who challenged the man who questioned his wife's virtue to a duel. He let the other man shoot first, took a bullet in the chest that knocked him down, put his hand over the wound to staunch the bleeding, stood up, and shot the other man between the eyes. Acquit yourself like a man, like professional basketball player Greg Ostertag, who is imperiling his lucrative career to give up a kidney for the transplant his sister desperately needs. Tony, girls are so precious in God's eyes that a man with God's heart knows he exists to sacrifice for them. Tony, if your heart is modeled after the Father's, then you will welcome the foreigner. Ruth is from Moab. She wonders how Boaz could call her his daughter. She fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you would notice me, a foreigner?" He has heard of her conversion. He is impressed with her faith. Like Abraham, she left her idol-worshipping family for a land and a future unknown to her. Boaz knows that God does not forbid the Israelites to marry foreign women, but he forbids them to marry pagan women. This is still God's plan today. Tony, marry in the faith. Marry a woman who loves Jesus and has been loved by him. I don't care if she's black, Hispanic, Asian, turquoise, or orange. She will be welcome in our house. I don't have to tell you our churches and culture are patently xenophobic. One of the weakest aspects of Citrus County life is our lack of exposure to people unlike us. When I hear people remark on how thrilled I must be to have gotten out of Miami, what with all the Cubans down there, I delight to tell them that the Cubans are the best Americans I've ever met. Tony, your generation is the most passionate about America being multi-ethnic and intolerant of racism. You've had the chance to go to Japan, the Philippines, the Dominican Republic, and Jamaica. You've seen how colorful and diverse heaven will be. North America is being flooded with immigrants, and many Christians will respond to this with a surly, nativistic protectionism. This is our country, and we aren't sharing it. Our forefathers came here from Europe, though, to create a land from which they could spread the gospel to the whole earth. If God brings the whole earth to America, let's welcome them here and thank God for the chance to introduce them to his son. Tony, your heart is lavish, and your father's heart is lavish, and you have tasted of it. As your heart is molded in the image of his, you will share liberally with others. Look at Boaz. At mealtime, he shares his food with Ruth in such abundance, she not only eats to satisfaction, but brings home leftovers. Boaz instructs his reapers to purposely drop grain in her path, so that she will be phenomenally productive in her gleaning. When Ruth returns home, Naomi can't believe how much she has gathered until he learns that Ruth had stumbled into a field of their kinsmen. Boaz's generosity is extraordinary. Tony, I remember once I took one of your siblings to swim practice. She brought 5 pieces of gum to share with others. By the time practice was over, she had consumed 4 of them. I said, I want you to give that last piece to that little girl. And she looked at me with incredulity and said, "No way, Dad, give away the last piece." It was unthinkable to her. That's the way children are, but that's not the way men are. I read this week of a 3,000-member church in Virginia where they have a 2-year plan to pay off every member's credit card debt. They are radically sharing. They know that to whom much is given, much is required. Tony, one of your most outstanding qualities is your generosity. You love to give. It's so manly. Son, you know I love that you have purposed to learn to be as generous with your heart as you are with your money. Give your heart away with wild abandon, too. Maybe you can teach your dad about that. Last of all, the man who is being fashioned after God's heart embraces the calling of the Redeemer. As you know, Boaz was not just a nice guy to a couple of needy women. He was Ruth's kinsman Redeemer. As the nearest male blood relative, he was responsible to marry the widow of his deceased family member. This redemption was understood to be costly, sacrificial, and involved a great price. It appears Boaz was a distant enough relative that he was under no legal obligation, but he came to Ruth's rescue because his heart had itself experienced redemption. A new family was begun by the sacrificial action of the kinsman redeemer, the family of Jesus, who later would create a new family by his own redemptive sacrifice. All this to say, Tony, this is the calling of your life. As John Eldridge wrote, a man needs to feel the rhythms of the earth. He needs to have in hand something real, the tiller of a boat, a set of reins, the roughness of rope, or simply a shovel. Can a man live all his days to keep his fingernails clean and trim? Is that what a boy dreams of. So what better thing to get your fingernails dirty with than laying down your life for Jesus? Masculinity is those distinctly male characteristics which delight in the sacrificing of our strength for God's glory and for others' good. I love when you called me after watching We Were Soldiers once. We loved the depiction of Hal Moore, the commander who was the first man on the battlefield and the last one off. He was the leader who stood in the fire unmoved for his men. Son, I love to see you rising to the calling to be strong, sacrificial, and courageous. I think of Maximus in the movie Gladiator, when after his remarkable display of courage in the Colosseum, the foul emperor, Commodus, the emperor who had strangled his own father and killed Maximus' wife and son brutally, comes down to the arena floor to meet this valiant gladiator, whose identity is hidden behind his helmet. I know you remember the scene. Commodus says, "Your fame is well deserved, Spaniard. There's never been a gladiator that matched you. Reveal yourself. What's your real name?" "My name is Gladiator," Maximus walks away. "How dare you show your back to me, slave? Remove your helmet and tell me your name." At that, slowly, very slowly, Maximus lifts his helmet and turns to face his enemy. "My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the north, general of the Felix legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or in the next." Why was Maximus so valiant and so resolute? Because he knew who he was and what his purpose was. So do you, son. You are the unmerited recipient of redemption. Now you are to go and redeem others with all your strength. King Jesus has called you. You belong to him. You are his son. You are his soldier. You are to be a warrior in his charge. Your mom and I love the way you're wearing the mantle of older brother. You so bless your sisters and your little brother with your love and your counsel. We never dreamed our kids would love each other like you guys do. Tony, you get the lion's share of credit for that. You are lifting your siblings on your shoulders like your older brother Jesus has lifted you. Tony, it was said in another great movie, Braveheart, "All men die, but few men ever really live." I so rejoice in your 20th birthday that this is not true of you. By God's grace, you are sucking the marrow out of most every day. By God's grace, you are acquitting yourself as a man. I praise him for you. I love being your dad, and I look forward to years of friendship with you. And should death ever tragically interrupt our relationship, know until we meet again, and we will meet again, that your mom and I consider you, your sisters, and your little brother to be the reason we were created, the highest calling we were given, and the absolute delight of our lives. With all my love, Dad. Amen.